This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Recognize this song?
But you blinded me with science. She blinded me with science.
Of course, it's She Blinded Me With Science, a huge hit from the 80s and one of the most fun science-inspired songs ever. The singer is Thomas Dolby. He was a pioneer in early synthesizer pop music, and his stage shows were full of crazy gadgets, knobs, and retro technology. But he is also the man behind another familiar tune. Of course, that's the musical cell phone ringtone. Thomas Dolby left the music industry 20 years ago for a career in Silicon Valley. His company made the polyphonic ringtone synthesizer that's in over 3 billion phones. Chances are you have time, or you have him to thank him for your cell phone ringer. How could you not remember that cell phone tone? Dolby is making a comeback this year in the music industry. He has a new EP out with a very different sound, and he's here to talk about music and technology. Thomas Dolby is a musician, a producer, and the founder of Beatnik Incorporated, and music director of the TED Conferences. His new EP is called Oceania. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you. Very nice to be with you.
Thank you very much. You know, science nerds everywhere are forever indebted to you for making science sound so cool.
I thought it was you guys that made my song a hit.
I wish we had been around that long. We've only been around 20 years, not 30. But thank you for the compliment. Well, compliment. In the 80s, you used all sorts of retro gadgets in your shows. Did you always love old technology?
I love things that used to be modern. You know, I love H.G. Wells and Jules Verne and stuff like that. And the technology that excites me most is the stuff that is so new that it's mind-boggling and nobody really knows what to do with it. And as an artist, I sort of step up and go, oh, I've got an idea what you can do with it.
Mm-hmm. And your new music, which we're going to play a little bit later, from your new EP, is very different. I mean, it's almost like it's going back to the 50s sounds a bit.
It's a lot more organic, I think,
yeah,
than the sound that people are probably familiar with. And, you know, the thing is, you know, 30 years ago when I was working with electronics, they were very rare and expensive. I mean, my first Fairlight cost me $100,000, and only myself, Peter Gabriel, and Kate Bush had them. So, of course, I felt like a pioneer. But these days, for $1.99, you can get an iPhone app that does more than my Fairlight did back then. And so that's great news for people that want to dabble. You know, with music, it's really for every man at this point. But for somebody like myself, I can no longer feel like a pioneer because statistically, the chances are somewhere in the world has come up with the same exact combination of sounds that I did. Mm-hmm. I've never run with the herd, you know. So I've gone back the other way. I've gone back to songwriting because I can do that uniquely. And I think that, you know, the personality behind the songs is what really sets my music apart.
Mm-hmm. So you didn't do it just to get back into the retro age of vacuum tubes and vinyl coming back.
I see, you know, toys and devices as a means to an end, really. It's all about the music at the end of the day. I don't think that, you know, I mean, there are geeks who care a lot about how music is made. But at the end of the day, when you hear a great piece of music or a lovely melody or a lovely voice, It communicates with you on an emotional level, and it transcends the technology that was used to create it.
Mm-hmm. I noticed that a couple of songs on your EP are sort of environmental named. Is that on purpose?
Well, I think it's a lot of that's down to the environment that I made them in. I live back in the UK now on the East Coast facing the North Sea. And in my garden, instead of the proverbial sort of garden shed studio that a lot of musicians seem to have these days, our garden floods from time to time. So I put my studio in a vintage lifeboat from the 1930s, and I got local traditional boat builders to build me a fabulous control room in the wheelhouse. And I look out over the sea in one direction and marshes in another direction, and the power comes from a wind turbine on the mast and solar panels on the roof. So whenever it's windy and sunny enough, I've got enough power to do some music. So obviously, working under those kind of conditions is going to have a huge influence on what you hear, not least because there's no soundproofing, so every time the boat creaks, you hear it on the mic.
Do you need a foghorn?
All the time.
Why did you leave the music industry after having so much success with it? You dropped out for a couple of decades.
Yeah, well, you know, at the end of the 80s, the beginning of the 90s, the music industry seemed to be going sort of into a recession. And it was a very bad time for showbiz in general. It was the Gulf War, you know, and so on. And I saw some very exciting possibilities in the world of technology, the internet, video games, virtual reality, eventually the web, and eventually mobile phones and so on. And rather than be in the music industry, which was trying to dig in its heels and slow down the rate of progress, I wanted to go to Silicon Valley and help accelerate it. So I went there initially to help companies like Apple and Microsoft and so on get sound and music into their products. And over time, it became sort of a killer app, especially for people like Apple. And so it was much more interesting for me, given my inclination to work as a pioneer, to be in Silicon Valley at that point rather than in the music industry.
Did you know Robert Moog and people like that?
Yeah, I mean, I'd brushed shoulders with all of those guys, yeah. And obviously I'd always tried to talk to them about the developments they were making. But I suppose eventually, when I got a taste for that, I thought, well, I want to start my own company here and make my own products. And so that was what gave birth to Beatnik.
Are you going to start touring again?
Absolutely, yeah. I'm going to be touring at the end of this year when my album comes out. But that hopefully will be with a full band.
Is there anything in particular about science that you found interesting as a child at all? Did that influence the themeology of your music?
I mean, I think I'm a dabbler, really. You know, I never had the patience to really be a good scientist. I like to sort of see flashes of inspiration in all sorts of different things. But I'm at my most creative when I don't really know what on earth I'm doing. When I'm sort of fumbling around trying to find out how something works, that's when I have to be a little bit ingenious and come up with an innovative solution.
Tell us what it's like for you to be an observer on the music industry, watching the music industry change so much over your career. What is your impression of it?
Well, it needed to change because it was kind of a bit broken. But I actually think that now is a very exciting time for the music industry, and I'll tell you why. I mean, if you're a 17-year-old kid now with musical talent, you believe that the moment the world hears your music, they're going to fall in love with you, and you'll be a superstar overnight. And today, that's actually possible. No guarantees, but it is actually possible. Because when I started out, I thought the same thing. But it turned out that actually, before the public fell in love with me, first I had to get a tape to an A&R man, and then sign a contract, and the marketing department had to have a window. And then the radio programmers and retail, and only when I got through that whole obstacle course would the public actually get to listen to my music and decide for itself. So, I mean, I think that the way the music industry is going is very, very healthy for music, and I think there's great music being made these days, probably behind closed doors or in high schools, and that we haven't even imagined. Hmm. So I think the way forward is a very healthy one.
And the fact that anybody can put their own video up on YouTube and get skirt that whole industry, you were all those hoops that you'd have to jump through.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, you look at Jessie J, who you know, a couple of months ago was in her bedroom in her pajamas doing, you know, little YouTube videos, and suddenly she's a global superstar. So it really can happen these days, and I think that's fantastic.
And so you see all the social media as a very positive thing.
Well, I think it's incredibly positive. It's also, you know, the other thing that's great about it for an artist is that the public knows when I'm writing a song, who I'm collaborating with. You know, they might get to hear a rough mix late at night for it that's up on the net for a couple of hours, and then I'll take it down again. They might hear a new version of the song with a redesigned second verse in next month, and 5 years from now the music I do today will still have a shelf life. And this is a great thing, because this is the way artists work and the way we feel. We're not geared up for, you know, street dates and release schedules and marketing windows and stuff like that. It was very much a construct of the record industry when it was all about manufacturing, but I think that in this virtual world, it's a much healthier way to live, really, as an artist.
And because everybody can have their own synthesizer and make their own music today, would that be one of the reasons why you went back to the non-electronic instruments?
You know, my motto is very much only do what only you can do. And I think that, you know, in the 80s when I started out, although there were many different artists and musicians working with electronics, the difference really with my songs was that they were compositions that I could have sat down at the piano and played to you, and you still would have got a feeling for the song, for the atmosphere, for the flavor, the personality of the song. So the synths that I was using were there to embellish that and add layers of texture and so on, but what was underlying was, you know, a very strong songwriting sense. And so that's what I'm focused on today, because I think today that's the rarefied commodity. There's electronics up the wazoo, but there's very few people writing great songs.
Well, I want to thank you very much for taking time to be with us today, and good luck to you and on your new album and on your tour.
Thanks a lot, Ira. See you soon.
See you soon. Thomas Dolby is a musician and producer. He's the co-founder of Beatnik Incorporated and musical director of the TED Conferences. His new EP is called Oceania, and we'll give you a little flavor of that. Thomas Dolby's new album. This song is called To the Lifeboats. We're going to take a lifeboat break ourselves. We'll be right back after this break. Stay with us.
As the rising cost of gasoline shifts consumer demand to fuel-efficient cars, American carmakers are finding new success in the small car market. As NPR's Sonari Glinton reports, in the first quarter of this year, General Motors and Ford posted the kind of profits they haven't seen in a decade.
If you want to find out how much things have changed in the American auto industry in the last few years and months, you can drop by your local dealership. That's what I did.
Let's walk over to the... I want to show you something here on a window sticker.
Meet Jim Flynn. He's a sales manager at Fairlane Ford in Dearborn, Michigan. Flynn walks over to a Ford Fiesta, a subcompact car. He points to the window sticker and the miles per gallon.
I'd say in 9 out of 10 purchasers right now, this is weighing heavily.
With gas prices well over $4 in Michigan, Flynn says there's one question every single customer is asking.
What's the best fuel economy vehicle you have? That's really... I'd say 9 out of 10 of them. I had a father and daughter this morning. She's a college student, and they're looking for something with good fuel economy to put her in on the road in the morning.
Flynn says 10 years ago, customers could have cared less about the gas mileage. He was one of them.
Myself, I could lease an F-150 for $275 a month. That's no longer the case. And when you're spending $100 to fill a vehicle up, now, you want to make sure you have a specific use for it as opposed to it just being a daily driver.
Flynn used to drive an F-150. Now he drives a compact car, a Ford Focus. Not everyone is making such a drastic downshift, but many are, and it's showing in the numbers. Sales of Ford's compact car, the Focus, were up 22% last month. Chevy's new compact, the Cruze, is selling far better than the car it replaced, the Chevy Cobalt, did a year ago.
A lot of strange things that we've never seen before are happening in the marketplace right now.
Michelle Krebs is an analyst with Edmunds.com. She met up with me at the Fairlane dealership. Krebs says there are many reasons the American car companies are winning over small car customers. One of them is...
The earthquake and tsunami in Japan has disrupted production of small Japanese fuel-efficient cars. We're going to see shortages for quite some time, probably. So that opened the door to competitors.
Krebs says it's not just the lack of supply that's hurting the Japanese. Their small cars have gotten, well, less cool.
What we're seeing with some of these new entries by the Americans and the Koreans is they feel like cars for younger people.
Krebs says there's been a huge push with the American automakers to dig deep on creature comforts and design of their small cars.
And so they're attractive to younger buyers, but they're also attractive to older buyers who want to feel young. And, you know, we baby boomers never want to get old. So while, you know, a Ford Fiesta may be aimed at somebody who's 25 years old, that makes it cool with someone who's 55 years old because they think they're young.
Krebs says she can't remember the last time the American car companies were hip and cool, or for that matter, fuel efficient. Sonari Glinton, NPR News.
You're listening to NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Melissa Block.
I'm Robert Siegel, and we begin this week's All Tech Considered with A Voice from the Past.
This is the third broadcast made on behalf of 45 Allied children who've been Nazi captives and have no homes.
After World War II, the BBC made routine announcements like this one. The broadcasts listed names in an effort to reunite families. Millions of children were separated from their families by the Nazis, and now the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum in Washington, D.C., is trying to piece together what became of some of those young survivors. And as the BBC did at the time, the museum is using the best available technology. To date, that means social media. Claire O'Neill has our story.
Will anybody who recognizes himself right to the British Red Cross?
You just can imagine how long it would take someone to write a letter, for the letter to be opened, and then for the child to be located back in Europe.
Dr. Lisa Yavnai is the director of the Holocaust Museum's Survivors and Victims Resource Center.
The difference now is that with the social networking, with Facebook and Twitter, it's instant. We put this website up, and within 24 hours, we got our first identification.
It was a man in France who was only 2 when the photo was taken. He found it through Facebook and emailed the museum using the I Know This Child icon on the page that has his photo. Yavnai's work is part of an online effort to find some 1,100 children, now in their 60s, 70s, and 80s, whose photos the museum has, to get their stories and to spread awareness about war from a child's perspective.
These are some of these photos.
She's looking through a box of carefully preserved prints, faces of children from 2 months to 18 years old, mostly Jewish, a wide range of nationalities, French, Ukrainian, Polish. Many of them smile at the camera.
And this is all we know. The name is written on the back with a stamp with the date August 14, 1946. This is when the photo was taken. We don't know anything else about this child except that aid workers took the photo to help identify her family.
You don't need to be in D.C. to see the pictures. All you need is a computer and maybe a Facebook account to respond.
I've been on Facebook for several years through my kids and grandkids.
Theo Meichler saw his photo for the first time in an email from the museum at his home in Houston, Texas.
We are sitting in my office here, and I have some pictures from that era. But I'm used to see those pictures all the time, so it doesn't stop me anymore. That picture, when I saw it, got my attention.
In the photo on the website, Meichler looks to be about 7 or 8, a full head of neatly combed hair, a fresh face, and right by that image you can see him today, 65 years later. His Facebook profile picture IDs a comment that he left. "This is me indeed, with more hair and less wrinkles," he writes, not happy.
It was a photo that brought me back to a time that was not a very happy time in my life. I remember living in a house behind a railroad station where my father had a case good manufacturing. I remember when two Gestapo agents came and arrested him.
Meichler never saw his father again. He was reunited with his mother and brother after the war, but the picture stirs emotions that have troubled him for much of his adult life.
My father went through several camps, Buchenwald, Auschwitz, I think Treblinka.
Jean-Claude Goldbrenner was too young to remember his father's departure, but he recalls his return.
I have a memory of my father coming back totally emaciated, walking with cane, and that's probably the first memory I have of my father.
Today, Goldbrenner lives in Maryland and was about two or three when his photo was taken. He rediscovered it by Googling himself. He's kept in touch with some of his childhood friends, especially when artifacts like these photos emerge.
I mean, that's my picture, and these are the two friends that I found at the time.
For Goldbrenner's generation, the past has been a bit of a puzzle, pieced together through the years with photos and conversations and letters, like the ones his aunt sent him later in life, written by his mother. Through that correspondence, he learned the details of her death. She was killed, 6 to 7 months pregnant, at Auschwitz. She was 28 years old.
Most of us either didn't think or didn't dare to ask questions. I think when you're young, it's probably a question of what didn't think. And when you're older, didn't dare too much to stir these memories.
The U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum wants to stir memories, starting with a simple question, the name of the photo project, Remember Me? Claire O'Neill, NPR News.
Osama bin Laden may have railed against capitalism, but on the internet, his death has sparked a gold rush. As NPR's Laura Seidel reports, profit seekers are grabbing up domain names.
Like a lot of Americans, Jacob Rautenbeek was glued to the television, learning the details of how U.S. forces got bin Laden.
And I thought, this is going to be an amazing movie.
Well, he lives in L.A. The next thing Rautenbeek did is run to his computer. For $11, he registered the domain name binladenfilm.com.
The best case scenario is that we actually end up selling it to potentially a movie studio or a domain speculator who's trying to cash in off the film.
Rautenbeek says he's already had a couple of offers, but he's holding out because he's heard there are several movies in the pipeline. Rautenbeek's rush to cash in on the bin Laden death is far from unique.
We saw a pretty significant spike in the number of names that were registered just after the announcement.
Christine Jones is the general counsel for GoDaddy.com, which is the largest domain name registrar. Jones says in the first 15 hours after bin Laden's death, more than 1,500 new domain names related to the event were registered. That's more than in all of the last 3 years. They ran the gamut from OsamaDeadT.com, a site that sells T-shirts to celebrate his death, to OsamaBinLadenDead.com. This kind of morbid speculation in domain names isn't unusual, says Jones.
9/11, we saw a big spike. Michael Jackson's death, the Virginia Tech shootings. Anything that has big media attention pointed at it, there will be a spike in the domain names registered.
Clearly, nothing is sacred in this domain. When the last pope died, Jones says people registered what they thought might be the name of the next pope.
And I'll be darned if somebody didn't figure it out and registered the name of the new pope before the name of the new pope was announced.
But most of the time, no one makes any money, says Andrew Alleman, the editor of Domain Name Wire, which follows the industry.
They'll list it on eBay, trying to find someone who will pay for it, but rarely is that the case.
Alleman says Hollywood studios will usually put a dash in a name or be creative rather than spend a lot of money on a domain. He says the people who have made money selling domain names haven't picked them based on an event. One of the highest-selling domain names ever, sex.com, sold for more than $10 million. Laura Seidel, NPR News.
From NPR News, it's All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Melissa Block. Microsoft announced today that it is buying the internet phone service Skype for $8.5 billion. Skype has grown rapidly since it was founded in 2003, but it still loses money. So as NPR's Wendy Kaufman reports, there were a lot of questions today about whether the deal makes sense.
This is Microsoft's most expensive acquisition, and it's one Microsoft CEO Steve Ballmer is excited about.
By bringing together the best of Microsoft and the best of Skype, we will empower people around the world with new technologies that should bring them closer together.
Ballmer, along with Skype CEO Tony Bates, spoke at a news conference this morning. The deal will combine the world's largest software company, Microsoft, with one of the leading internet communications companies. Indeed, the Skype brand name is so strong that to Skype has become a verb. With an internet-connected device, Skype's more than 170 million users can connect for free with family and friends using messaging, voice, and video. For a small fee, they can also call landlines or mobile phones almost anywhere in the world. Microsoft hopes to integrate those services and more into its current line of products, including email, links, even its Xbox Kinect. Again, Steve Ballmer.
This Skype acquisition is entirely consistent with our ambitious, forward-looking, irrepressible nature. Sometimes we build things ourselves, and at other times we'll make an acquisition. One that plays to our strengths and is much more than the sum of its parts.
Ted Shadler, a principal analyst at Forrester Research, thinks the deal makes sense. Microsoft, he says, has to compete in a post-Windows world and with the likes of Google.
In order to do that, you need something that people want to use every day. And that's what Skype is. Skype is something that people want to use in the home every day.
Microsoft would like to see Skype become something that's used in the workplace every day as well. Shadler says Skype could be integrated into Microsoft's business software.
So, for example, you could be at work talking on a phone, and you could Skype out to a customer and have a video conference with a customer right from your office desk. And that's a very powerful thing.
Businesses do some of that now, but the combination of Microsoft and Skype could allow them to do it in an easy, secure, and readily managed way. And in a way that companies might be willing to pay for it. Right now, just a tiny fraction of Skype's users pay anything at all, and the company has not produced much in terms of net profit. While Microsoft and Skype say there's lots of revenue potential in this deal, many analysts think Microsoft overpaid. Michael Cherry, an analyst with the independent research group Directions on Microsoft, is one of them. He says Microsoft bought Skype partly as a defensive maneuver.
Microsoft saw the potential here to add to their existing services and keep a potentially viable asset out of the hands of competitors.
Google, Facebook, and Cisco have all been talked about as potential Skype suitors, though Skype was considering an IPO when Microsoft made its unsolicited offer. The deal must still be approved by U.S. and possibly European regulators. The companies hope the acquisition can be completed by the end of the year. Wendy Kaufman, NPR News.
Executives from the biggest brands in mobile computing were summoned to Capitol Hill today. Lawmakers peppered Google and Apple executives with questions about how they track their customers and store data about their whereabouts with or without permission. The executives argued that their location technology makes their services popular, but members of Congress reacted with skepticism, as NPR's Audie Cornish reports.
Laura Pollack is a homemaker visiting Washington from Palm Beach Gardens, Florida, and she's only too happy to show off her smartphone.
Okay, there you go. See, that blue thing is showing us exactly where we are.
Which can pinpoint her every move.
Shows us in the Capitol.
It shows you right in the building.
Yep.
At what point is too close?
Yeah, that's a little too close. Yeah. Yeah. But I wonder where the information is going. I really don't know how secure it is.
And that's a problem for researchers and regulators who worry that customers don't understand how the information can be exploited. It could be accessed by anyone from computer hackers to stalkers to third parties like insurance companies looking to spy on their customers' bad habits. Jessica Rich with the Consumer Protection Office and the Federal Trade Commission was among those who testified before a Senate Judiciary Subcommittee at a hearing on privacy.
If it's collected over time, you can also know what church somebody has gone to, what political meeting they've gone to, when and where they walk to and from school. So that is sensitive data that requires special protection.
Apple says they fixed a bug that kept on tracking even after the customer switched off the location services. And in the future, it will keep less of the data, and what it does, it will keep encrypted. Beyond that, the company's VP for software technology, Bud Tribble, tried to dispel fears that the company tracked identifying information.
I want you to reassure you that Apple was never tracking an individual's actual location from the information residing in that cache. Furthermore, the location data that was seen on the iPhone was not the past or present location of the iPhone, but rather the location of Wi-Fi hotspots and cell towers surrounding the iPhone's location.
Apple wasn't the only one facing scrutiny. Google executive Alan Davidson also sought to reassure lawmakers like Senate Democrat Sheldon Whitehouse, who had concerns about third-party apps gathering or selling information from the devices. Davidson tried to make an analogy, but Whitehouse wasn't buying it.
We don't go after trucking companies because they happen to carry faulty goods. We go after the manufacturers of those goods. And I would just say we're trying to strike the right balance.
You do go after the trucking company if the company knew what it was carrying.
And I think this is...
Google's in a better position to know what is being carried as a professional company that specializes and has vast resources than a 17-year-old who's been told by his friend that this is a cool app to load.
Caught in the crossfire are representatives from app makers, small software development companies who worry that more regulation will hobble their efforts to get their products out there. There'll be plenty for them to watch on the Hill in coming weeks as lawmakers in the House and Senate are writing new legislative language to add privacy protections on mobile devices. Audie Cornish, NPR News, The Capitol.